case of the day, which is State versus $18,000. Counsel, good morning to you. Give me a second. Mr. Sipp, good morning to you. And you may approach, but before you start, Ms. Passel, you are also here. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Do you understand the timing system? You're ahead of me, but that is great.
With beats, I will stop.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Sipp. You may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Bradley Sipp. I represent the appellant, Christopher Bolden. The primary issue in this case is if there was sufficiency of evidence to forfeit $18,000 from a traffic stop. On August 1st, 2020, Mr. Bolden was stopped in Seward County, Nebraska for following too close. The officer noted that he was driving a rental car, that he had a radar detector and a cooler in his car that he had drinks in so he wouldn't have to stop. The officer invited him back to his cruiser and wrote him a ticket. Eventually, Mr. Bolden's car was searched, and the officers found $18,000 of cash wrapped in a sleeping bag in Mr. Bolden's car. The police seized that money, didn't write Mr. Bolden wasn't cited for a crime, and they let him go his separate way. The county attorney's office in Seward County, pursuant to Nebraska Revised Statute 28431, filed a suit to determine whether or not that money should be forfeited. Mr. Bolden then filed an answer or a claim against the money. A trial was had in which Mr. Bolden did not appear. The state did call a deputy, the deputy that made the stop, and he stated that he, in fact, believed that the $18,000 was to be used as drug money or to purchase drugs. And the reasons he gave again were that Mr. Bolden was driving a rental car, that he had a radar detector, and radar detectors are often used by people to avoid law enforcement. He also stated he had a cooler. Mr. Bolden had told the officer that he was going to Colorado from Richmond, Virginia, to hike, that he was going to the Denver, Colorado, and the Fort Collins, Colorado area.
Had he made that sort of trip a couple of times before with a rental vehicle for about the same period of time, and what, if anything, do we make of that evidence?
Judge, he had made that trip at least twice before. Same kind of time frame, I believe, renting a vehicle for about 1 week, leaving Richmond, Virginia, going to Colorado, and then returning to Richmond, Virginia. The deputy would like to say that shows that he's somehow going to Colorado to purchase drugs and then returning to Richmond, Virginia. And the fact that Richmond, Virginia is a large city is one of the things that the deputy would point out that would make him believe that. I would say that shows us that he likes to go to Colorado, and nothing more than that.
Mr. Sipp, so far your argument has focused entirely on the sufficiency of the evidence. But your brief, I understood to focus more on the burden of proof.
Yes.
Are you still arguing that the trial court applied an incorrect burden of proof?
I think this court needs to determine what the correct burden of proof is. The statute did change in 2016, and it changed from the case law had been beyond a reasonable doubt. And
why would the burden of proof not change when the statute changed?
So the issue here is that this is a criminal case. And so as a criminal case, beyond a reasonable doubt seems to be the correct standard. I understand that the legislature changed it to clear and convincing evidence.
So your argument would be that the statute is unconstitutional because it applies, it calls for a burden of proof lower than beyond a reasonable doubt, despite the criminal nature of the proceeding.
My argument has not been that it's unconstitutional, but that the judge applied the wrong standard. I would submit to you.
But what leeway does the judge have to apply a standard other than the one set by the legislature?
And I would submit to you that in the past the case law had been beyond a reasonable doubt.
But wasn't that case law based on a previous statute that said beyond a reasonable doubt?
I don't know that the statute said beyond a reasonable doubt. I assume that it did. Okay, I know that the case law did. But if it was and the statute changed, then Judge, you are correct. The correct standard is clear and convincing evidence. But it's my argument that there's no nexus between these facts from this stop, the fact that he had a cooler and these different things, and he does have some criminal history, as the court knows, and the fact that this money should be forfeited.
Did you present any argument in your brief that there was an absence of a nexus between the facts?
I only stated in the brief that there was an insufficiency of evidence, that there was not sufficient evidence.
So if the prior statute said beyond a reasonable doubt, and the current statute, which you agree changed, says clear and convincing evidence, are you conceding that your first assignment of error lacks merit?
I would concede that, Judge.
Mr. Sipp, you've been talking about burden of proof, but the statute that we're talking about actually mentions two burdens of proof, and a much lower one if your client had shown up for the hearing. So if the person from whom the property is seized shows up for the hearing, all they've got to do is prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the property wasn't being used to violate the act, and they get it back.
Correct, Judge. It's a two-prong approach. If they show up at trial, and of course he did not show up at trial, I was not his counsel of record then, he was pro se. If he'd shown up at trial, he could have shown by a preponderance of evidence that that money or property was not going to be used to violate the act. He did not, so then it goes to prong two. And prong two would be that the state would have to show, I think we've agreed now, by clear and convincing evidence that in fact that money was used to violate the act.
So is it a civil statute until it becomes more like a criminal statute?
Well, I think that's part of the problem, is that it's listed in chapter 28, which is crimes and punishments. In the past, the court has found the old statute to be criminal in nature. Double jeopardy would apply. And so this is kind of this quasi-criminal and civil. Obviously, it's I would call it a civil forfeiture of this asset.
I beg your pardon, do we need to answer that question if we're just looking at the statute?
I don't think you have to answer that question. I think what
and
the
now, so then you resume to your merits and you're saying your client wasn't there, right? So the burden was on the other side and they said what they said and you're saying it's not enough.
I'm saying it's mere conjecture. That what the officer said was mere conjecture. The idea that he was alerted to this, that somehow his professional knowledge, that the dog that was in the car didn't look like a hiking dog.
Was this admissible or objected to as speculation and conjecture?
All of those things were admitted into evidence because Mr. Bolden did not appear, and so the state simply presented their case to the district court.
Would we find in your brief an argument that the evidence was insufficient?
You would only find statements that it's insufficient. There is a very short, we're talking about a couple of sentences, that the evidence was insufficient to forfeit the money.
Is that sufficient to meet our requirement that assignments of error be both specifically assigned and specifically argued?
I believe that the issue would have been that again, it's the same, it ends up being the same argument as far as facts. It's the same facts that are in both briefs, and that is that there isn't enough evidence to show by clear and convincing or beyond a reasonable doubt that, in fact, this money was used to violate the act. And just that statement gives you the argument that, in fact, there's not sufficiency of evidence. And the same facts apply to burden of proof and if the evidence was sufficient or not.
The officer here gave a litany of reasons why you believe this money was tied to the distribution of drugs, did he not?
He did.
And you've addressed a handful of them showing to basically attempt to cut the legs out from his reasoning. But isn't it fair to say that when the district court's reviewing this, it reviews all that reasoning as a group, as opposed to each one individually?
The problem here is, unlike other cases, State versus 1985 Mercedes, there, the owner of the car that lost the car, he wasn't arrested for anything. Crack cocaine was found in the car. A warm crack pipe was found there. There were other things that went along other than just conjecture.
Did the officer testify about his training and experience and knowledge that he's gained?
He did. He did testify, obviously, for foundational purposes. All of the training that he had had, drug interdiction training.
So the court heard that evidence, as well as the evidence of what was found in the vehicle, as well as what the officer's opinion was of what those facts meant based on his training.
And again, Judge, and it would be our position that it's just an opinion, so we would ask that the
opinion
order of
the officer?
Yes. He wasn't an expert, and the things he was testifying about were mere conjecture. We would ask that it be remanded for further hearing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tassel, good morning to you. You may approach.
Thank you. Good morning.
Reset the timer there.
Oh, good. Good morning, Chief Justice Hevekin. May it please the court. My name is Lori Passold. I represent the state of Nebraska and filed the petition on behalf of the state of Nebraska to forfeit the $18,000 currency that was found in Mr. Bolden's possession in 2020 pursuant to 28431. The issue before the court, as I saw it, was whether the proper burden of proof was applied at the trial court level, and the state believes that it was. As the court is aware, in 2016, the Nebraska legislature amended 28431 and changed the burden of proof from beyond a reasonable doubt to clear and convincing evidence. There were other changes made to the statutory scheme surrounding forfeiture of property that's seized from people, and it's the state's position that the changes that were made at that time changed what this court has previously deemed to be a criminal forfeiture under 28431 to a civil forfeiture.
Do we need to decide in this case whether the forfeiture is criminal or civil in nature?
I'm asking the court to do that. I think that if this court says based on the scheme of the statute, even though it says clear and convincing, this is still a criminal in nature statute, there's potentially a problem because what do we do with, there's no beyond reasonable doubt. So I would ask the court to look to this and say, yes, the statute changed, and this is now a civil forfeiture.
Are there some sequelae or consequences to a pronouncement by this court that the statute changed from criminal to civil?
Yes.
Why do you want that for future cases, and what should we be leery of?
I think the consequence is that if the court were to determine that this is now a civil forfeiture rather than a criminal forfeiture, if the proceedings are brought pursuant to 28431, and I want to be clear about that, because at the time that these amendments were made, the legislature also put into place a pathway for a criminal forfeiture. So the state believes that there are two pathways now to forfeit proceeds money like this. The consequence, if this court finds that this is a civil forfeiture, using that clear convincing evidence standard, is that the double jeopardy analysis when it comes to a companion criminal proceeding would no longer apply. Or that would certainly be the state's position. I know that
that's the point of the question.
Right.
Why would you insist to the extent that you're urging us to make a ruling and a distinction?
Would the distinction also affect our standard of review? And I'm sorry I interrupted your answer.
I think it might.
Just cue mine up behind.
Sure. And I struggled with that when I wrote my brief because it's my position that this is a civil forfeiture. If that's the case, the standard review by this court is different. I believe it's de novo on the record on in rem actions. I believe that that's correct. I still think that the review by this court would find that the evidence was sufficient to uphold the court's determination at the trial court level. And perhaps the court does not have to make the determination that this is a civil forfeiture. Again, I understand on its face when the statute was modified, it now says clear and convincing, and I can just come up here and say, look, that is the proper standard that was applied in this case. I know that the court will also think through the prior precedent that this court has used in Franco and other prior forfeiture cases. Using the analysis of whether a case is or a statute is a civil forfeiture or criminal forfeiture, looking at the legislative intent, and if the legislative intent appears to be civil, is there a penalty that then puts it into a criminal arena? And again, that's where the state's position is that this all points to it being a civil forfeiture.
Assuming that the district court judge used the right standard, what do you think our standard of review is here? Perhaps you've already articulated that, but
if the court finds that this is a civil forfeiture, I think the standard review is de novo on the record. I understand in criminal cases, the standard is different, and I've stated that in my brief. So I think that's one of the reasons why this court will be thinking about whether this is in fact a civil forfeiture or remains a criminal forfeiture.
Isn't the de novo on the record standard applicable in equity matters? If this
yes.
were a matter of law, wouldn't we apply the clearly erroneous as to the facts and de novo only on the law?
That could be. And Justice Castle, I will acknowledge that I'm a criminal prosecutor, and so I don't think about the civil standards as much. I did think about it when I was writing this brief, but I was in the position of knowing what the court has previously said about the standard of review in the context of the court's prior findings that it was a civil case. So if I've misstated it, I know there's prior well-established case law in terms of the standards of review.
Prior findings that it was civil or prior findings that it was
criminal? Criminal.
You misspoke.
Sorry, no. I appreciate that. So again, I think that the legislative intent with these changes in 2016, on its face it says clear and convincing. The legislature put into place, as the court is aware, a pathway to have a criminal forfeiture that can be part of the process at the time of sentencing if somebody is convicted under the drug statutes, specifically possession with intent to deliver, attempted possession with intent to deliver, that's a criminal forfeiture. That was a response, I believe, to this court's ruling in Franco regarding double jeopardy. And the court invited, or at least cleared the pathway for the legislature to make those changes in Franco.
Let's assume your opponent would argue that the placement of the statute or the retention of the statute in the chapter on crimes and punishments would, by argument, make it a criminal proceeding. What would your response to that be?
I know that this court and other courts, the United States Supreme Court, have looked to the title of the statute or the code or the placement of that, but that's not dispositive. Certainly in the state of Nebraska, the title of the statute is determined by the revisor of statutes. It's not determined by the legislature. So I think that has very little impact on what the legislative intent of a statute is. The fact that it can be found in Chapter 28, again, should not be dispositive of it. I think there's a lot of other factors that the court needs to look to. Did the burden of proof change? It did. It's no longer beyond a reasonable doubt, and now it's clear and convincing evidence.
Your argument would be that its placement would not be dispositive, but you would concede, would you not, that it, when it was amended as amendment to 28431 so that the legislature knew where this particular statute was going to be placed.
That's absolutely correct. But I think that that placement in and of itself should not control that determination as to whether it's civil or not. Again, I've discussed the fact that there's two pathways. It's not just as it relates to drug money. At the same time, the legislature created those two pathways for child pornography cases. They did it for gambling cases, in which they amended the criminal portion of those offenses, creating the ability to forfeit through the criminal prosecution and or separately do that through a civil proceeding. Again, the burden of proof was modified. And
so if we get to the issue of sufficiency of the evidence, is there sufficient evidence that this money was used in violation of the act?
Your Honor, the state would argue to the court that there was sufficient evidence to find by clear and convincing evidence.
It's all circumstantial.
It's all circumstantial based
on... Found.
No drugs were found. The smell of drugs was found. Not only, or the officer himself could smell a faint odor of drugs on the food sealer that was found in Mr. Bolden's possession that he would say was going to be used to seal food while he was hiking on his trip.
So isn't it possible, given the state of the record and these arguments, that our standard of review, assuming we were to conclude it was a civil statute, might make a difference? If we're reviewing factual determinations for clear error or reviewing de novo?
I would argue not in this case. I think the evidence, even applying a different standard, would convince this court that the evidence was sufficient. And as a result, the state would ask the court affirm the lower court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you. That concludes arguments then in State versus $18,000. And as I noted before, you are excused and you can leave if you want.